So, I was going to not give a talk this evening and just see what happened if I didn't do that. But, and partly because I feel kind of raw today, kind of maybe vulnerable, or for various reasons. I feel actually a little bit shaky inside, in a way. I was at a meeting today at one of the Buddhist groups that I'm very much involved in. And there's been interpersonal conflicts in the group for over a year, and a series of very painful meetings trying to work it out. And today, it fell on me to kind of be in the hot seat, and I had to say very strong things. And it came through also with my anger that I felt. And so to have this concentrated time to express my frustration and anger and kind of be working out the conflicts with people left me kind of feeling kind of tender or raw or vulnerable. And so somehow it didn't, I just thought, well, I'll just come to you in that way and see what happens. But I said, I was sitting at dinner, and then I started writing a couple of notes of things maybe I wanted to say. So should I say those? So, someone I met today at this meeting who I don't know very well, who's kind of does some kind of work. It's kind of like therapy. Maybe it's not therapy. I didn't quite understand what it was, but like therapy. And he said he works with people usually on a short-term basis, so he doesn't see what happens to people over a long time. But for some various reasons, there were two or three people that he's been seeing now for 2 years, and 2 years for him is a very long time. And in the course of those 2 years, these people have become happy. They were unhappy, and now they're happy. So you think that's, well, it's great, right? But he was actually troubled a little bit. And the reason he was troubled was that these people who are now happy had no expression of gratitude. And he thought that was a bit odd, that there was he didn't go on and explain it any more than that, but that there was no gratitude in their happiness or in their kind of who they were or their life in that point. He felt it was a little bit odd and a little bit imbalanced, that a life that doesn't have gratitude, a happy life that doesn't have gratitude in it, I don't want to speak for him, but I thought it was quite interesting. And I wonder how many times therapists are concerned that their clients end up feeling gratitude as the result of their course of therapy. And this issue was also pointed out in an article I read recently by a Japanese American Buddhist priest who kind of works with the Japanese Buddhist congregation as a priest. But he also received training and a PhD, I think, in psychology. He teaches psychology at some university, and so he's also a therapist. And so he has his two roles. And he finds that when he talks to European Americans, and they find out that he knows, his psychology and Buddhist background, European Americans are really all they want to hear about is psychology and therapy and how Buddhism can help them in their kind of, make them happy in a therapeutic kind of way. And that's the focus of what they want to hear. But when he talks to the Asian American community, the Japanese American community, that's not what they want to hear. They want to hear, the themes that they want to hear about is the themes of gratitude, humility, oneness, and death and dying. That's what he wrote about in his article. Those are the themes they wanted to talk about. And gratitude and humility, I mean, how many times have you gone to a therapist who's going to teach you some humility? It just doesn't compute somehow. Oh, so you have a problem. Oh, okay, come on, let's talk about your problem and what you need. Actually, what you need is to be more humble. That does a lot of good to your self-esteem, to be told that. So therapy is often sometimes about building self-esteem. And then it's interesting the difference between East and West, Japan, for example, or Asia. I think in America. I think Ajahn Sumedho made somewhat similar comment about when he teaches in Thai, he speaks Thai fluently, so when he speaks as a Buddhist monk to the Thais in Thailand, he talks about kind of basic Buddhist teachings that are kind of universal, kind of universal aspects of our humanity. But when he comes, teaches in the West, he talks about psychology, about, you know, our self-worth and our self-esteem and about our problems with the, you know, whatever, you know, things that more kind of what we belong to, what we in the West call the world of psychology. And it's not like one is good or bad. It isn't, this is not supposed to be a value judgment, but it's very interesting to see the difference of where people put their emphasis. I've also read that in, and I kind of saw this somewhat indirectly in, when I was living in Japan, that in Japanese Zen monasteries, there's a distinction between the kind of human problem, the problems that we have that the Zen practice addresses. And they distinguish between mind troubles and human troubles. And mind troubles is what you take to the therapist. And human troubles is what you go talk to the Buddhist priest about, or what your Buddhist practice is about. And human problems are those universal problems that we all share. Death, dying, old age, sickness, loss of loved ones, impermanence, things are constantly changing. Issues of self-centeredness and freedom from self-centeredness, transcending self-centeredness. Kind of more the human condition rather than the particular conditions that have to do with our particular biography, our particular life story. And one of the struggles that Vipassana teachers talk about sometimes when they get together is on retreats we have very short time for interviews. About 15 minutes usually, sometimes 10 minutes for an interview. And sometimes Westerners think of a meditation interview to be like going to your therapist. And in therapy, it takes like 50 minutes to warm up. You know, you have lots of time to tell your story and, you know, really make sure they understand the history and the background of all that. But it's actually kind of hard to do that in 15 minutes. And so sometimes it's kind of a pity because a person will spend 14 and a half minutes telling their story, making sure that the teacher understands their story. In the 30 seconds left, there's no time for the teacher to kind of impart, you know, all their wisdom they might have. So this emphasis on the story is very important in the West. And there's something about perhaps where there's a way of relating to our life. The story is not as important as it is sometimes in our particular focus. Sometimes it's very important to focus on the story part, but not to dismiss that, but what I'm trying to say is perhaps there's another way of looking at things that sometimes just hasn't been looked at very well, even in Buddhist circles in the West. I've heard this, I've noticed this actually in my own experience in Japan and in America with some Asian teachers. It's been said that often Asian teachers don't have any interest in people's students' personal lives. They actually don't learn anything about students' personal lives. One Zen student in Japan in a monastery there, who was there for a number of years, I think it was 3 years with this one teacher. And in those 3 years, the only thing the teacher ever asked him about his personal life was, how old are your parents? And where do they live? You know, and he said it, and that was it. And this particular Zen student was the attendant to the Zen masters. They had a lot of time to kind of hang out together and see each other. And the Zen master wasn't interested in his personal history. It wasn't really relevant. What he was interested in was in the spirituality of that student right then and there. Was a student meeting this particular moment in the fullness of this particular moment? Was there the kind of acceptance of oneself and of life that's possible when one kind of maybe transcends or the personal story or the personal, which is not to dismiss it. It's not that it goes away, but sometimes you put more emphasis on it than it's warranted. So, for example, going to this meeting today that I went to, I anticipated that I might get angry at the meeting, and I had all this little irritating kind of thoughts spinning around my head going to the meeting. Say, oh, I can't get angry. you know, this is a bunch of Buddhists I'm going to hang out with. I'm a Buddhist teacher. And these people, they're not going to like me because I'm expressing my anger. And they're going to have doubts about me whether I should be a teacher. And, you can all kinds of these thoughts about, oh, I can't do it. You know, who am I? You know, I haven't worked on myself enough. I have to go back to therapy and do another 20 years. And, you know, I have to kind of fix it. I have to fix this, you know, this issue. And, oh my God, you know, it's going to be a disaster today. I'm a little bit exaggerating, but there's all these thoughts like that spinning around. And so I came to the meeting, and the meeting happened, and I expressed my anger. It came out. I did, you know, just, you know, that it was just like, there was no choice anymore. It was just there, you know. So, and then I realized after a while that my dear friends were completely accepting me, even though I was expressing all this anger. And I realized how so much of my concerns about my anger and myself, my image, and how they'd see me and what I had to do to fix myself was irrelevant. How it had been fueled. I still was left my anger, which I still should practice with and, you know, come to terms with. It isn't like I'm kind of justifying my anger. But so much of the preoccupation with fixing it or judging it, the rug was pulled out from under it. And so, oh, I can just, it's okay to be who I am. Isn't that nice? I thought it was very nice. So, thank you. So the issue, you know, is Buddhist practice therapy, or is it something else? And if it's something else, what do we call it if we don't call it therapy? That one of the possible topics I was going to talk about today was faith. So I don't know if that's the... I don't think that's the right kind of distinction or category, you know, therapy and faith. But maybe there's something to it. Faith, you know. Faith is a very important element of Buddhist practice. But therapy. And this, I don't know if this is a good thing to say. Maybe you won't like me. You won't like me now if I say this. But I had the same concern. I said it at a retreat recently, and then no one seemed to get too upset. And then I checked out with some of my colleagues, Vipassana teachers, to see if they kind of agreed, because I thought it was kind of a little bit daring thing to say, because it was a comment about the Vipassana community that we're part of. And the observation I have is that it's not a big problem, but if our community, the Vipassana community in America, makes an error, errs in this particular direction, it errs in the direction of being too therapy-oriented. And I don't know if that's the right word, but a little bit too, people are a little bit too preoccupied with themselves in this scene. And with the kind of idea, what's in it for me? You know, what can I get from this? And so you see people coming to retreats. And it's a very individualistic approach. You know, I'm here. It's my meditation practice. It's my silence. You guys better not be quiet. You better not disturb me. I'm going to choose just the right work meditation so that I can get my retreat that I need to have. And I need to have just the right kind of protein, this kind of food, and I need to do this. And, you know, and there's all this negotiation, complicated negotiation, manipulation, and figuring out, planning ahead of time, all for so I can have the right thing, you know, what's good for me, what's right for me. And it takes one form, which I mentioned in on the retreat, is there's a phenomenon that some people who go on retreats for a lot don't stay to the end. Because sometimes the ending of the retreat is kind of the same. Retreats usually end kind of the same way every time. And after a while, they get bored with it or tired, or I don't know what they decide to do. But you know, it's no importance to them anymore. It's nothing in it for them anymore. So I just leave the retreat early and go home and do whatever I'm going to do. But what that does is that, you know, people don't understand their connection, the ways in which we support each other on a retreat, how we support each other in community. And we're not just simply individuals, but we are also in community, whether you know it or not. And to show some concern about how we relate to others and how we offer support or take away support is part, I think, of a wider spiritual life. That might or might not be part of therapy, because sometimes in therapy, it's very much focused on you and your well-being. Whereas in spirituality, the Zen master might not care about whether you get the right yogi job. But the Zen master might care very much about whether you stay to the end of the retreat, because that expresses the fact that you feel your connection to the others and you're supporting them. If people leave early, then people see them leaving early. And they say, oh, maybe I could go early. Or, you know, oh, who am I to stay? You know, all my friends are leaving, and am I the only one who's dumb enough to stay? And all these thoughts or whatever churn up for people that makes it difficult sometimes for the people who stay behind. So what's in it for me is one of the undercurrents sometimes of the kind of individualism you find in our culture sometimes. And it comes into our psychotherapized culture. I think we have a phenomenally psychologized culture. I mean, it's invisible to us how much it's so. I think it's really invisible to most of us. You know, it's just so pervasive. And I'm not interested in condemning it, but I'm interested in making what's blind be better seen. You find if you go to bookstores, if you go look in the psychology section, which is usually quite big, usually it's like 4 times, 5 times, 6 times, 7 times bigger than the spirituality section. You'll find books about psychology and every possible human subject. Psychology and your relationships, psychology and your work, psychology and your sex life, psychology and your therapy and your, you can imagine just everything. Someone has taken kind of a psychotherapeutic approach on everything we do, and you can get kind of like this manual about how it's going to help you and fix you and make you better. And I think it has been somewhat helpful for people to go to therapy. I think it's very important for some people. I recommend it at times. But one of the traps in therapy that I see, and I'm not an expert on this, is the same trap that I see on Vipassana retreats, where people focus so much on what's in it for me. And what's in it for me is a very odd animal, because it ties into who we think we are, our self-image of ourselves, and a self-identity of who we are. And self-image and self-identity are quite fluid, and our creations are they're not necessarily who we are in our essence, but they're often creations that our society helps us to create, that we create based on our experiences. And so if we're trying to become happy through therapy or through spirituality, and happy means to make our particular self-image work in society, to be well-adjusted with this image, this idea of who I am in this particular society, you can end up being kind of fulfilled or become more efficient worker or become more skilled in interpersonal relationships and therefore be happier. But it hasn't really addressed the deep, because you're better adjusted in this particular time and place. But this particular time and place might be insane. Someone said today that I don't really suffer from seasonal affective disorder. I suffer from a seasonal insanity disorder. There's something about this season when it comes around that there's all this frantic energy, and I get so frantic. I start doing so many different things, and just like there's no time for anything, and I get kind of insane. How many of you get a little bit insane at this time of year? So to become better adjusted in an insane society doesn't always make sense. And sometimes that's what happens in therapy, but not always. And that's sometimes what happens with the way we approach spirituality. We just simply find a way how can we make me work better for the situation. What's interesting to me, and which I can't talk about very well because I don't understand it well enough yet, but I have a very strong feeling or hunch or observation that there are fashions or styles in personalities over the decades and centuries and years, just like there's fashion in clothes or fashion in body types. You know, there's fashion in body types, right? And this is one of the terrible things about body types, is that finally you get the right body type for the 80s, and then it's the 90s. You know, you can never catch up. No, it closes every, you know, season. There's a new clothes, and you can't quite catch up. That's the stereotype, right? You kind of get your clothes for this season, then it's changed, and then you have to go buy some more, and you never quite catch up. The body types, you know, change slower than clothes, but they also change. So this was posted at Spirit Rock above the Xerox machine. So I Xeroxed it. This was subject, women. And this is also nice. The address, it's an email message from karuna@metta.net. I didn't know there was a metta.net. And those who don't know that, those Buddhist language, this person's address is compassion@love.net. So the subject is women. A psychological study in 1995 found that 3 minutes spent looking at models in a fashion magazine caused 70% of women to feel depressed, guilty, and shameful. 3 minutes. However, there are 3 billion women who don't look like supermodels, and only 8 who do. So why is it so depressing? And the models in these magazines are airbrushed. They're not perfect either. Marilyn Monroe wore a size 12. If Barbie were a real woman, she'd have to walk on all fours due to her proportions. The average American woman weighs 144 pounds and wears a size 12 and 14. One out of every 4 college-aged women has an eating disorder. Models who 20 years ago weighed 8% less than the average woman today weighs 23% less. So isn't that interesting? If shop mannequins were real women, they'd be too thin to menstruate. So we compare ourselves against some kind of fashion, some kind of style, and then we suffer because of that. And I think the same thing happens with personalities or our inner qualities of our mind or the kind of ways we speak, ways we see ourselves. There are fashions and styles. You know, if you listen to recordings, live recordings of people speaking from the 20s or 30s or, you know, every decade, there's kind of you'll see a kind of change in American idiom in the way people speak. You know, newscasters from the 40s sound very different from newscasters in the 60s and newscasters in the 1990s. There's styles in the way people speak. There's styles also in the kind of personalities that are kind of work for a particular decade or year or whatever. And I can't really exactly point to that. Maybe very roughly, you know, in the 50s, it was a stoic, silent kind of masculine guy. And in the 60s, there was a rebellious type that was in. And in the 70s, there was the vulnerable, express-it-all type. And in the 80s, there was the go-getter type. In the 90s, we haven't figured it out yet, maybe. What is it? Oh, so I don't know if you know. So what I'm trying to say is that because there's styles, also not only in something as intimate as our personality, and it changes because culture always changes, if we're always measuring our inner life, our personality, by what's in at this particular point in time, you'll always be unhappy. And it becomes a dead end, it becomes a vicious loop. Always you're going to therapy to try to make you feel better about yourself when you can never catch up to the particular style that's right now. So I don't know if that was said well or well argued or if you understand that. But there's a kind of a dead end or kind of a loop that can happen at times in the world of therapy, where therapy is about simply adjusting the self without any deeper reflection of what this self is, the self-image, the self-identity that we have. And perhaps we need sometimes to have the rug pulled from under our preoccupation with ourselves and fixing ourselves. I know some people who approach to Buddhist practice is fix it. they have a problem, they're going to use the practice to fix themselves and fix what's going on. And it's okay in some degree to have that attitude if they know how to put it down sometimes. But to always, I mean, these people I'm talking about now are always trying to fix themselves, always trying to just, you know, get something better and get a better experience or get something different or whatever. There's a place for acceptance. And there's a place for simply allowing ourselves to be who we are and not try to have the right body or the right whatever. Not try to always be the person who's not angry or try to be some kind of perfect idea of someone, but simply to accept ourselves who we are. And in that acceptance, to find some way to transcend the particular limited idea of who we think we are, that we're always often trying to adjust and to change, like changing the furniture on the Titanic. It's why keep bothering? You know, it's okay in its own place, but do we have to be so preoccupied always with it? Is there another way of looking at ourselves? Is it a different way of looking at our problems? We all have problems, and I don't want to dismiss them or belittle them exactly, but is there a new way of looking at them or looking at ourselves? So maybe it's okay. Part of what mindfulness practice does is we bring a mindfulness to carefully watch the flow of our life, the changing phenomena of our life, and then we notice in mindfulness where our attention gets lost, where our attention gets fixated or frozen on particular preoccupation. Not so much to get more involved in that preoccupation, but to help us free the awareness again. So the awareness becomes larger reality, larger sense of transcending reality than our particular preoccupations or thoughts about this is who I am, this is what I need, this is my history, this is what my mother did to me or whatever. To let the awareness kind of flow and not stop at thoughts of my mother or thoughts of my father. It's in one of the little cliches in Vipassana circles is, because some teacher said it many years ago and people liked it, was thoughts of your mother is not your mother. And that can be very liberating to realize that principle. So acceptance of ourselves, to sit and not try to fix anything. And that's actually one of the radical ways of sitting in meditation, is to sit, to accept oneself as one is, and not try to fix anything. And as we do that, if you're very honest and very mindful, what you'll notice is that even though you're trying not to fix things, there's a tremendous amount of momentum still of not accepting things and wanting things to be different and trying to make them different. And the more and more subtle and quieter the minds get, the more subtle and quieter you notice that that tendency might be. And it's actually very radical practice to simply step back. Each time you see that, step back and accept and accept and accept and not try to fix anything. Because as you do that, paradoxically, you let go of all the efforts to try to fix it, which is often that thing which causes us suffering to begin with. To not accept reality as it is, and to fight it or resist it or try to change it, that itself represents suffering. And to simply be open, with an open-hearted feeling towards life and towards oneself, and realize that all human beings are limited, all human beings share the quality of being neurotic, all human beings have their shadows and things they're embarrassed to talk about. All human beings are, you know, it's very difficult to be a human being if you hadn't noticed. And then we kind of notice, and then we try to hide it from each other. We try to hide it from ourselves. But can we just relax? And just kind of at least take a moment and say, well, maybe I can just accept this all pervasive, something larger than myself, larger than my particular concerns. And I think the subject of gratitude belongs to that, and humility. Humility is not thinking of yourself, it's not low self-esteem. It's not being critical of yourself. It's not being self-effacing. Humility, as I understand it, is not to see oneself through the filter of any kind of comparative judgments. Not to see oneself through any kind of judgments, either that one is better or worse than anyone. But just allow yourself to be present, to be alive, to make room for our aliveness, our vitality, to flow through us and tickle us and delight us and trouble us and cause pain for us and cause love for us, and to let just the vitality flow and let it flow and not be so defended or so concerned about how it looks. To allow ourselves to be who we are. Gratitude, humility. It's said in Buddhism that people who are shy are the people sometimes who need the most humility, because shyness is often a very radical preoccupation, very kind of radical kind of conceit. It's not the kind of conceit where you think you're better than others, but it's a kind of conceit where we think we're worse than others, or we have a very strong self-image about who we need to be. And actually, the kind of humility I'm talking about is also needed by shy people. So stop the kind of conceit that belongs with... Conceit has to do with comparative thinking about ourselves in front of others. Gratitude, humility, generosity. To feel grateful for being alive. It's said many, many times, it's almost a cliche, that the more advanced materialistically societies get, like here in the United States or in California or in Silicon Valley, the better off people are, and the more successful they are, and the more material goods they have, the more that this complicated web of other human beings have to be in place to support our very existence, the less grateful we feel. And the people who have less support from other people but actually live close to nature and feel the dependence on nature will often feel much more gratitude for being alive than those of us here who have much more reason to be grateful. Because it's phenomenal. It's really astounding the amount of effort that our fellow human beings perform so that we can basically get through one day. And when's the last time you stopped at the end of the day and said, wow, I'm really grateful for all those people. That guy who was there at the gas station so I could buy my gas. Yeah, I'm grateful that he was there. Otherwise, you know, if there was no gas station, I wouldn't have any gas, and I'd be stuck on 101 somewhere or whatever. Do we feel grateful? Is there any purpose to feeling gratefulness? Does gratefulness serve your self-interest? I hope not. In some ways it does, of course, but I hope you don't take it on as another thing to kind of for your own self-interest. So I kind of have a lot more to say, but I think I'm kind of running out of steam here, kind of meandering some. So probably that's a good place to stop and take a few questions. Oh, absolutely.
There's a way that you're talking about it that makes me just feel like you're saying, you know, therapy, you know, maybe short term is okay, but, you know, if you're in long term therapy somehow.
No. Yeah. Well, I appreciate, Phyllis, that you asked that. I tried at various points to try to qualify what I was saying, but I was kind of aware that maybe there was maybe too strong a distinction here being made. I suggest therapy to people at times. I think it's very, very important and really crucial for some people to do therapy. Buddhism is going to relate to Westerners and Western society, it has to have a profound appreciation for the psychological needs that we have here, and not to assume that Westerners are Asians who don't have the kind of psychological needs that are unique to our culture. And I think it's very important for some people to do therapy, and it's been very helpful for people. And at the same time, I know that for some people who do therapy, it's a dead end, and it just ends up not really offering them something actually more transcendental than therapy. I know lots of people who just spend endless years and years and years going to this therapist and that therapist. And what they really need is someone to pull the rug from under them rather than all the little adjustments they're making. And the people who endlessly read self-help books, just endlessly, it becomes empty after a while. So I believe, I hope it's true what I'm saying, that I'm pointing to something which is problematic in our over-therapized society sometimes. But it's not to dismiss therapy. And I think it's very important. It's very extremely important at times.
I just have a concern that your words could maybe strike someone in a way that would make them feel bad, you know, about being in therapy.
Or being a therapist. or being a therapist.
It doesn't make me feel bad about being a therapist at all. Yeah. I mean, for me, I just wonder about how many people in this room are in therapy.
I think a lot. And so I said, as I said before, that I tried to qualify a number of times while I spoke. Didn't I do that?
Yeah.
So I tried to qualify it, and actually appreciate the fact the first question, you know, gives us a chance to kind of say this more again. But I think that also, I was kind of just speaking from a little bit from how I was feeling today. Number of things, and this—that was very, very. I was deeply struck by this man who said that, you know, his kind of clients, after being happy, they weren't grateful. That really struck me, and it's kind of like I was kind of building on that theme. And I realized that this role that I have here does have some power, and that people sometimes listen to me more carefully than I deserve to be listened to. But also it gives. I think part of this role up here. Is also sometimes to say things which are challenging. And a little bit behind me today was just try to say something which is challenging, which maybe isn't said so often. And I don't think I said it very skillfully today, because I was groping how to say it. But I think there's a place also to be challenging. And what I hope is that people like you, and all of you, but you know, I think what you did now was just perfect, are willing to challenge me in return. And if you guys aren't willing to challenge me, there's a problem. Is that enough?
Oh, I could say a lot more.
Yeah, we can.
Let me call you.
Okay. Yes.
I think there's also a distinction between what we come into therapy for and what we come into Vipassana for, in terms of our attitude. And what I wanted to ask you about was that I see, not within this group and not within the sati retreats that I've been on, but at some Vipassana retreats, that they are getting very into psychological interactions and, you know, things between people and stuff. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that, because to me that's the flip side. Is that?
Well, it's a big subject, and I think that this is it isn't just simply what Vipassana students bring to the Vipassana scene. But it's also what Vipassana teachers bring to it, because we're all in it together. And there, you know, and we're all kind of in this also Western psychological world very much together. And so some Vipassana teacher, you know, majority of the Spirit Rock Vipassana teachers are therapists. So you can't really be too down on therapy. You know, there's really, you know, they have a tremendous respect for therapy. And Jack Kornfield, in his writings, has made impassioned pleas, and that's the word I think he uses, pleas, that people actually become more understanding of the importance of doing psychological work. Because he's seen over the years so many people who come to Vipassana have issues which need to be resolved, that are better resolved in therapy than they are sitting on the cushion through Vipassana. So it's a huge issue, and the teachers also do it. And why some teachers choose to do more than others, and why some teachers stay completely away from therapy, is a big issue. You know, some teachers are afraid of students' emotions, and so they don't want to touch anything that's psychological because of their own fear. Some of them don't want to do anything that looks like psychology because of, you know, some understanding they have, particular understanding they have of Dharma or the truth or spiritual practice. Some people are very psychological in the way they teach because they found that's really useful and really helpful. And some people are overly psychological because they've kind of maybe gotten kind of caught in this whole Western psychological mindset, and they don't see anything beyond that. So it's a very complicated issue, and we're all in it together. You know, I'm not holding myself apart from all this. I'm just kind of in the mire too.
I think though, as someone that goes to day retreats and things, that there's times when I've ended up at a retreat which I've gone to not for psychological reasons, and then all of a sudden in this interaction that seems like a group, you know, thing, and when I really went for a day of peace and quiet, and it's difficult sometimes to recognize from the write-ups, you know, from even Spirit Rock,
it's a very good
what
point.
Is and what isn't. You know, I'd like them to say this is going to be, it's just, it's the other side, I think, so,
yeah. Yeah. So this is an issue which is going to take decades or centuries to sort out. When Buddhism came to China, it got mixed up with Taoism, and it took like 400 years for the Chinese to sort out the Taoism from the Buddhism. Buddhism comes to the West, and we mix it up with psychology, and it's going to take us a while to figure out these issues. And I really don't mean to give a blanket criticism on psychology and therapy. I think it's very, very important, and it's phenomenal. I think I have tremendous respect for the insights and understanding that Western therapy psychology has developed over the years of its doing its work. And I'm really, very, really excited about what's going to come in the next decades as the world of psychology continues its research and continues their studying of the mind. It's really, really exciting. And it's going to be, I hope it's also a very healthy challenge to Buddhism as Western psychological culture gets more sophisticated. But, it's a dialogue, and it'll take us all a while. But if your spiritual tradition doesn't challenge you, then, you should look more carefully at your tradition. But I think we should start. I know this is a hot topic, but we need to be also sensitive to the people coming in here today, the homeless, and it's 9 o'clock, and it would be good if we kind of vacated the premises somewhat promptly so that they could come in and have their dinner. Thank you all.